Hi there. Allow me to welcome you to the 11th lecture of the Deep Reinforcement Learning course already. So I hope you're hearing fine. Are there any questions, comments? Would you like to ask something or discuss something? Definitely. It's used both for training and prediction. However, during prediction or like during playing of the games, much larger number of simulations is being used. So during training, we just use these 800 simulations for each step. But during prediction, the system can easily do something like 10,000 of simulations in order to get as best idea what the policy and the value function is as possible. So for these, so for example, this is a comparison for chess, how many simulations it does per move. So it's something like more than 10,000 simulations. So all these results here, they like run the Monte Carlo tree set as long as possible during the prediction so that they have enough time. And for example, now here when you have got the same times and the smaller times, it means the less simulations will be performed during the Monte Carlo tree search. And you can see that if you don't do enough of the tree search, like if you just do like I don't know hundreds of simulations or tens, then you will easily lose. Yes, it is possible to do it, but the results are usually not as good. So this explicit planning of like thinking of what the tree look like can make the performance better, but it is possible also to just use the policy network, just the policy generated by the network without any further simulations, definitely. Well, it's slower, definitely. Like here, when they are trying to beat the best existing player, like a chess player, for example, then of course it makes sense to use as much time as possible. So if you have like a chess clock, you know that you have got, I don't know, 2 hours for the whole match, then you can decide how you will spend your time. So they weren't here trying to be fast, they just tried to use as much do as much computation as possible in the allotted time, right? And you can see that if you like decrease the number of time given, then at some point it will start losing, right? So when it's using 1/10 of the time compared to the opponent, then it's still better. But if it only uses 1/30 of the time of the opponent, then the alpha beta search in Stockfish gets better. So generally, the Monte Carlo research allows you to like trade off the performance, like the computational performance, for your playing performance. So the computation requirements for how good you are. But of course, doing a lot of simulations takes a lot of time. And the bad thing about the Monte Carlo tree search is that it's sequential. So you like go through one node, then you expand the node. So you need to call your model on just one input. And then you start again from the top. And then you do these. And you need to perform these simulations like one by one, these evaluations one by one, which is not that great with the current accelerators. During training, it's not that bad because during training, you can run the multiple games in parallel. So each game says, oh, I want to perform the evaluation, and you can do it. But when you are really playing somebody, then the parallelization is a bit tricky. Thank you very much. Some other comments, questions, ideas? I will eventually expand the slides on Alpha Zero. I wanted first to discuss like the general Monte Carlo 3D search and then the improvements what the Alpha Zero did. But I concentrated more on creating the slides on the today's lecture, but they will it will be updated there at some point. Yep. We will discuss Alpha Zero as well in the second half of the lecture. Hopefully, we'll get there. But before we get to that, let's start by discussing the scale of the rewards. When playing the Atari or solving the Atari environments, one of the major obstacles is to be able to process rewards on vastly different scales. Some of these scales are like plus 24 is maximum and minus 24 is minimum for a return, for example. And some of these returns are like 1 plus 1 million minus 1 million. So there are like vast different scales. In the original DQN networks, the authors got around it by just clipping the rewards, right? So just everything is plus one, which is positive, and everything is minus one, which is negative. So you just know, oh, that's a good thing, but you don't know how good it actually is. For example, there is a game called Bowling, in which you trial to like really hurl the ball on the and I've forgotten how these things are called. So these things which you want to knock over with the ball. And when you hit some of them, you get a reward, which is proportional to the number of pins, I think they are pins, you have knocked over. But with the clipping, you just see that you knocked at least one, right? But you are not really sure how many of them did you knock. That definitely must be suboptimal, right? So we will now discuss two ways how we can get around this issue. The first is an improvement to an Impala architecture. And what does it do is that it performs normalization of the task rewards from the data, right? So instead of clipping the rewards, it will compute the statistics, the means and the variances of the rewards and normalize them. This way, it will be able to handle both very large and very small rewards, and it will be even allow them to train a single agent. In Impala, we saw this as well, that there was just a like multi-agent trained on all the games. But these the scales of the reward was one of the problems which it suffered from. So now we will improve it. And so what will we do? The value estimate, the V, will be computed using some normalized predictor. So we will have a network which will generate or compute we will have a critic which will compute the value estimates in some normalized way, so that zero is actually the mean, and the distribution of these normalized estimated returns has a variance of one. And then we will have a constant, like a standard deviation and the mean, which will be combined with this normalized estimate. So it will be multiplied by the standard deviation and increased by the mean. This normalized value estimate is computed by some neural network. Right, so the last layer of that network is probably a fully connected layer, right, with parameters which we will denote W, and some bias which we will denote B. Now there are some beginnings of the network. So this is what the network generates, and then we know that if you want the real value estimate, not just the normalized one, we need to multiply it by sigma and add mu. Yep. So this is our setting. What we will do is we will track the standard deviation and mean using the exponentially moving average. Because whenever we see or compute some reward, we will just different way. Whenever we use some value as the target for the critic, and the target will probably be some bootstrap return, then we will use it for updating our running exponential moving averages of means and variances. And we will have some decay rate, just exponential moving average, right? So something which we have seen many times, I would think. We need to track the standard deviation, which might be tricky. So what we do is we track the first moment and the second moment, and then we can compute the standard deviation at any time by the obvious formula, where we center the second moment and compute the square root. Yep. And in the paper, they use quite a small decay rate so that we don't really change the mu's and the standard deviation too often. But the problem is that when we update this mu and sigma, it changes the value prediction of the network. It can give me quite a lot. Like if we are seeing larger returns, then we might be increasing our estimate of the standard deviation. But if we increase this value, then the values predicted by the network will suddenly be larger. But that's the tricky thing and the bad thing, and that's why it has taken so long for it to be used or to be applied, right? Because changing or updating the estimates change or modifies the output which our network has. But nothing really changed, right? We trained that this some kind of output should have a return of 10. And just the fact that we are seeing on average larger returns doesn't mean that our prediction should change. Our prediction should be the same. But if we are predicting the normalized value, then if we change the statistics, then it will definitely change the output, and that's a bad thing. So how to get around that? Well, we will get around that by using this knowledge about how the last layer look like. We know that the last layer is just a fully connected layer with a bias. Right, so it looks like this. This value is computed as sigma times the normalized predictor. The normalized predictor is the fully connected part, right, plus the bias. Now, assume that we have observed some change in the parameters, so that the mu's has changed from mu to mu prime, and sigma has changed from sigma to sigma prime. And the trick is that we will, when we update these estimates, we will at the same time change the parameters of this last layer of the neural network, so of this W and B, so that after all of these changes, the output of the value network will be the same. So whenever we update these mu's and sigmas, we will at the same time update these W's and B's, so that the value estimate, this V output, is actually unchanged even if we update the statistics. So that's the main trick. Now to see what the math should look like. So assume that we are updating the sigma to be sigma prime. So what we need to do, well, originally the output was multiplied by sigma, and now it will be multiplied by sigma prime. So what do we do is we take the W and multiplied by sigma and divided by sigma prime, right? Because then it will give exactly the same output as before the normalization, right? Because the originally it was sigma times W, and now after the update, it will be sigma prime times sigma over sigma prime times W, which is the same as before. And the same for B, for the bias, right? We multiplied the bias by sigma and divided it by sigma prime. So that's how we handle the change in sigma. And we might also need to adapt to change in the mu. So if mu changes to mu prime, then, we will just add the mu and subtract the mu prime from this numerator of this fraction. Right, originally there was a plus mu, now there will be plus mu prime. So we subtract mu prime and add mu, so that when the mu prime is added, it will get cancelled and it will be as before. Yep, so this is the main trick, right? We will track the normalized return, which is a good thing because we'll be able to handle just the values from minus 5 to 5 or something like that. Everything will be scaled dynamically. And whenever we update our estimates of the mean and variance, we change at the same time the normalized prediction network to adapt to this immediately, right? So when we change the statistics, we also change the output of the normalized value predictor, right? Now in the multitask settings, when the network, when we train the actor, which will be able to process different games, then the actor will generate the critic will generate different value estimates for the different games, right? If you want some agent to be trained on a lot of games, then it makes sense to allow the critic to actually know what game is being played, so that this normalized prediction will be a vector of all the possible, of the estimated return for all the existing games. This will be the matrix, this will be a vector. And whenever we are doing it like that, then these sigmas and mus will also be vectors, right? There will be like task specific vectors, but other than that, the updates are all the same. So whenever one of these statistic changes, we update the corresponding parts of the W and B. Right, is it fine? Hopefully it is. So let's look at what the results look like compared to the Impala results. This is so-called pop art Impala. They like probably pop art very much, but it stands for preserving outputs precisely while adaptively rescaling targets. For some reason they just like popular arts had hard time of coming up with the acronym. So I actually didn't finish this beginning. So if we can track these value estimates and the mean and the variance of the estimated returns, then whenever we observe some unnormalized return, we can normalize it by subtracting the mean and dividing by the standard deviation, and then use the usual actor-critic algorithm where we use this value as the advantage. So we take the normalized estimated return and the observed return, which we normalized from the original ranges to the new one. The good thing is that like the baseline is happening automatically, like the normalization. Like this normal normalization should be zero on average, right? Because zero is the mean, and the range or the size of the advantage should be like reasonably limited. So there should be less problems with the gradient propagation, which seems to actually be the case when we look at the results. So when we compare these values, these are the usual Atari 57 in the with the no-op starts and the human starts. And the results are substantially better with the pop-art in power. One thing is that the gradients may be smoother or nicer because it's probably easier to track the normalized value estimate. And also we are able to not just use the clipped rewards, but actually use the full rewards so that we know not just that some action is good, but actually how good it actually is. But in this first table, the clipped rewards are still being used, right? So with the clipped rewards, you can see that we benefit just from being able to train an easier or to solve an easier task by predicting the normalized value estimates. When we process the unclipped rewards, then you can see that the Impala itself just diverges during training, and the Popart Impala is able to train, but you can see that it actually does not benefit from seeing the unclipped reward. So we can train reasonably well. Unfortunately, the results are not really better. So we survived the unclipped rewards, but we didn't improve. And then these are the graphs in just like more graphic representation. Here, what we can see is like a regular Impala, right? This blue one, that's this, maybe it should be in blue. This blue one is this Impala. Then the Popart Impala is the orange one. Now this violet one, that's so-called multi-head Impala. So that's an Impala which has different predicted values for different games, but there is no normalization, right? So we train the critic to predict the estimates using the task-specific layers. However, the normalization is not being performed. So you can see that it's not like that this multi outputs would benefit, would help Impala. What actually helps Impala is the normalization. Note that this is the evaluation of a single agent which is able to play any game in the Atari in the Atari collection, right? That's why the numbers seem so low, like 57 or 28%, right? Because this is the performance of a single agent. However, using this Popart normalization, you can see that the agent is actually slightly better than human in both the no-op starts and the human starts. If we are using unclipped rewards, then the normalization is the only thing which can actually train something, and the rest of the Impalas just doesn't train at all. And here are the visualization of how the statistics evolve during training. So these are the undiscounted reward on the bottom of the like training episodes. And here you can see what the normalization look like. So there is the mean, that's the dark orange oscillating one. And there is the plus sigma minus sigma one standard deviation range. So you can see that the statistics track the real undiscounted returns reasonably nicely. That's probably not that important. Here are the reruns with different seats, but unfortunately it seems that the transparency is not working well in the slides. So it's just like a huge jumbo of different runs. But what the authors want to show is that what the variance in the different training runs look like. And it seems it's not such bad with the Popart Impala compared to the original Impala, where you can see that the estimates are more noisy, or the progress of the training is more noisy. So this was one way how to deal with the rewards on different scale, right? Learn the normalization. There is also another approach, and I would say the one which has been mostly adapted for the Atari environments nowadays. And it's based on the so-called transformed rewards. So consider a Bellman operator. We have already seen something like that. When the Bellman operator gets some Q value estimate, then it produces another Q value estimate, and the produced Q value estimates, when it gets state an action, what it does, well, it does this one step, temporal bootstrapping estimate. So it samples the state and reward from the MDP dynamics. And the return estimate is the reward, the observed reward, plus gamma times the best, the expectation of the best possible actions in the next state. Right, so this is the one-step bootstrapping, which we use with Q-learning. So now we have caught that Bellman operator. Normally we have defined it for the value function, but we can define it analogously like this for the action value function. And now the main trick, or the main idea in this transformed rewards approach, is to reuse the magnitude of rewards by using some like squashing function, which will reduce their scale. And when we have such a squashing function, we can define the transformed Bellman operator, which computes the estimate somehow, and then passes it through this function H, right, through this squashing function. And if what we do here, well, this Q, that's our squashed estimate already. So in order to combine it with the observed reward, which is not squashed, we need to unsquash the estimate, right? So we apply the inverse of this quotient function. We compute the maximum, multiply gamma, add it to the reward, and then squash it again, right? So if we want to compute the estimates using these transformed rewards, then when combining two of them together, we need to like unsquash it, combine, and squash again. This transformed Bellman operator was suggested in a two-year-old paper called Observe and Look Further by Tobias Polen and many others. And they prove two simple propositions about this. First, if this transformation is just a linear scaling, right? If this H is just alpha times the Z for any Z, then iterating this transform Bellman backup operator converges to the H times the optimum action value function, which is just the alpha times action value function. So it kind of makes sense. If we just want to scale the the rewards linearly just by multiplying them by a constant. Then it's completely equivalent to scaling the rewards, right? It doesn't really matter if this h like multiplies this q by 1 over alpha, adds reward and then multiply it by alpha, or if this multiplication by alpha goes directly to r and we multiply rewards, right? So that's exactly what this says. If this transformation is just a scaling by a constant, then this transform operator converges to the optimum of the previous one just multiplied by alpha. So the more interesting proposition is the following one. Now, when h is strictly monotonically increasing and the MDP is deterministic, then again, the iterative application of this transformed Hebelmann operator converges to the optimum action value function composed with the transformation. So this is what we want, right? We want to somehow change the scale so that the optimum action value function does not change or changes just by application of this transformation, but otherwise it doesn't change. So the optimum behavior will be the same. The only thing which changes is the scale of the reward. So what we needed for that, we needed h, which is strictly monotonically increasing. Well, we will just use this to see that the h minus one exists and is easy to work with, right? Because if something is strictly monotonically increasing, then it's inverted. But the important point will be that the MDP is deterministic. For stochastic environments, this actually does not work. So if the MDP is stochastic, then this theorem is not necessarily true. It can be proven under different conditions, but a much weaker one. Specifically, it can be proven that this is actually a contraction, but only for a constant which depends on the Lipschitz continuousness of the function. So it's not really used nowadays, so I just skipped over the theory. In that case, if you are interested, there is some appendix of the original paper, but we will just use this version. It's not difficult to see that this is the case. So let's look like what the H composed with the Q looks like. Well, the optimum value function is a fixed point of the original backup operator, so we can rewrite it like this. And now, because the h is invertible, we can also just add the inverse and the original transformation here to the q action value function. Now we can look at the definition. So here in this transform operator, there are two things, right? First, we need to use h, the inverse of h on the q, on the input. And then on the output, we need to apply h, right? So imagine that this expectation is not here. If the expectation is not here, then we can take the original operator, right? And then pass q through h minus h to minus 1 to the inverse of h, then use the original operator and then apply h, right? So if this expectation is not there, then these things are the same. So that means that this is exactly the part which we'll get here to the they will contract and be the transformed Bellman operator. And this is actually, this actually means that this H composed with Q is the fixed point of the transform operator. But we needed this expectation to disappear. If this expectation is not here, then we are summing the ages for different possible numbers. And it's not necessarily true that the h is linear, right? H of a plus h of b, if you wanted the previous theorem to hold, then this would need to be h of a plus b, which doesn't necessarily need to be true. However, if this expectation is deterministic, so there's just one reward and just one next state, then we don't need this to be true because we only compute the h on the one value, right? So luckily, this is the case, for example, for the Atari environments. For the Atari environments, the authors decide to use, generally they want to use a square root, right? The idea is that, okay, the rewards, they are in the range of, I don't know, zero and thousands. So if we would compute the square root, that would be in the range of zero and 30s or something, or tens or dozens, larger tens. So that seemed like much more manageable range, while still being monotonically increasing and everything, right? So what we will use is we will use this value. We don't want the function, like we don't just want to use this, because then the derivation or the gradient at x equals zero would be like infinite, it would be very large. So to get around that, we have this plus one minus one here, right? So that instead of starting really like at the point where the gradient is too high, we take the square root of x and just start at some point, right? So we just take this and start nicely. What we also do is we add this linear regularization term. The problem with this formulation is that when we look at the inverse, then the inverse would be roughly x squared. That means that the inverse would have the gradient of roughly x, some linear element. But that means that the gradient would be unbounded, right? The larger the x, the larger the gradient would be. And that's unfortunate because the function would not be Lipschitz, which seems to be a good thing. So in order to make sure that also the inverse is reasonably bounded, we add this linear regularization term. This linear regularization term means that for very large x's, this is the element which will dominate. And it has a bounded derivation, right? It has the gradient of epsilon. So the Lipschitz constant to the inverse will be bounded by 1 over epsilon or something. However, for this epsilon is normally being used either 100th or in many other papers, they even use 1000th. So this is like a very minor element to make sure that if x is extremely large, then the h grows fast enough. If you would like to see what the functions look like, this is the inverse. This is just a straightforward inverse of this function. Generally, like as I said, they wanted to use the square root. This plus minus one is to make sure that the gradients of this function are bounded. This part is there so that we make sure that the gradients of the inverse is bounded. And this is just the inverse. The function looks approximately like this. Right now we are, this is like a parabola of right, these signs, they are there to make sure that it's really monotonically increasing also for the negative rewards. And then for the inverse, then it should really be something like, so it's not really a parabola. Asymptotically, it's actually a line, but at the beginning, it looks like a parabola. Oh, and it should go down, of course. Ah. Right, and the epsilon defines like how steep it's going to be. Right, so with a large epsilon, it would be larger, and the purple one will be less so. And on the other hand, with smaller epsilon, it will go lower, and the purple one will get steeper. This is what the authors proposed. They also did some evaluation, but they performed all the evaluation using some imitation learning. We didn't really talk much about it, so I didn't include their evaluation here in the today's lecture. And instead, we want this, I need to increase the volume of my computer. So the axes are the returns. The returns can easily be negative. So we also want to make sure that this works for the negative values, right? But just the square root of x would just fail, of course, for the negative values. So what we do is we make the function to be just, you would say lecha in Czech, so that's it's odd. I don't know if you say odd in English, but we just want to expand the function on for the negative values so that it's just the same function but just mirrored. So what we do is we add the absolute values inside the formula so that we compute it independently on the sine of x, and then we just and then we just want to include the sign, but it should look like this, right? So there is just an X missing here. I'm sorry, the sign itself is just plus or minus one, but there is an argument missing. So there should be sign x here. So this would be just plus or minus one, but then we multiply it by this. I'm sorry. I was creating a new operator for it because I didn't have it in my maths. And that's why I even if I copied it from the original paper, I just accidentally lost this application of x when I was creating a new macro. So sorry for that. Here it's correct. Mm-hmm. So let me write it correctly. So there is a sine of x times this inside. So the x plus one minus one. And plus epsilon times x, and the goal is that like this will be symmetrical, independent on the sign, and this part will make sure that when x is negative, then it will actually have the opposite sign, right? So this is even, like you would say, suda funkce, and when we multiply it by the sine of x, we make it into a lichá funkce, into an odd function. And this is an odd function from the beginning, so we don't need to do the arithmetic, the gymnastics. But if we wanted, we could say sine of x times the absolute value of x. And the same thing we do here. So sorry about that. Yep. So to see some evaluation, we will turn to R2D2 paper. Well, I think everybody wants to name their paper R2D2. There are many papers with R2D2 acronyms, so it's actually difficult to search for it using Google with R2D2. It's a year old, and it's like an ultimate deep Q network until this time, definitely. It uses recurrent state So there will be LSTMs. It uses experience replay. Well, you know it. And also distributed training. So that's why the recurrent replay distributed DQN. So generally, think about DQN. We will be like performing simulations. So we will be like collecting some episodes. And we will store all the transitions to a replay buffer. We will use a prioritized replay with the usual as in the rainbow. We are using double queue learning. And we are actually using n-step double queue learning with n5. So what we are doing is we are estimating the return as the sum of, I don't know, t, so that it will be gamma to I goes from 0 to n minus 1, probably. There will be, or maybe let's go from 1 to n, gamma to I minus 1 r t plus I, right? So these are discounted rewards in these five steps, plus gamma to n times the, like what we want here is the v in the next state, but we don't have the value estimates, but we have the q value estimates. So we will maximize over all actions of q. Okay, I will not be able to fit it there. So let's do it like this, times the maximum over all the actions of the q value estimate for the s t plus n and the action a. So this is what they mean by n-step double queue learning. This is not the double, this is just the estimate. Now, this algorithm is actually not off policy, right? Because these rewards, they depend on actions which are generated by some behavior policy, and we are probably computing the estimate of some different target policy, and they just don't mind. That's the same thing as in Rainbow. They also use this n-step estimate of return and just ignore the fact that we are training it in a different regime. So they do it as well. As for the architecture, we use the convolutional layer. It's a Q network, right? We start with states. There are some convolutions. Normally, we would compute the estimates of returns of performing the actions in the given states. However, we at this point add an LSTM, right? So we've got LSTM. It has got the dimensionality of 512. Now this is passed to dualink architecture, right? This dualink architecture generated the value estimate V and the advantages and combine them together into a Q function, right? So there will be like zoop, 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 something like this. And that's what the architecture looks like. We are generating the experience in a distributed way by 256 actors, each like getting the current parameters of the policy, like running for some number of time, and then sending the trajectories to the server. The server has this prioritized replay buffer, which it samples from, learns, and once upon a time it distributes the parameters of the Q network to the actors, right? So the distributivity is very similar to what Impala does. However, we want to train the LSTM, right? We want to train recurrent cells. So we cannot just train like on single transitions, because if we train on a single transitions, then the LSTMs will not learn anything. Instead, we want to make sure that the LSTMs will actually strain. So we will consider not just sequences of one transition, but a much larger one. We will consider the episodes of 80 transitions. So 80 transitions, state, action, and reward. Next state, next action, next reward, and so on and so on and so on. And the adjacent sequences, they actually overlap by 40 time steps, right? So whenever we, after each 40 time steps, we take the last 81 and add them to the replay buffer, right? So that's what our replay buffer looks like. And then when we train for on this whole trajectory of 80 samples, right? So the input is not just one transition, but one 80 step long transition. But the question is, what to do with the initial state of the LSTM? Even if we have got 80 steps, then the LSTM for the first state needs to obtain the hidden state. And the question is where to get it. For Atari, the games are being played for 30 minutes. So there are like hundreds of thousands of transitions. So just like having 80 of them doesn't seem like a larger number of them. But anyway, the authors consider two ways how these states can be obtained. The first is so-called zero state, right? Zero state means we just use zero as the hidden state for the first LSTM. So that's a natural way. And the second is also quite natural. It's called stored state. So it means that whenever we are storing this transition to the replay buffer, then we store it also including the initial state at the time of actually generating the experience. So that's the stored state. The problem, of course, with the stored state is that when the agent or when the DQN changes, then this state should probably be different, right? It depends on all the previous observations, and we should update it when the behavior of the agent changes, but of course we have no way to do it. So these are two things, either stored state or zero state. And then the authors also talk about burn-in. So the burn-in, the idea of the burn-in is to allow the network to like adapt the hidden state so that it makes sense, like especially for the zero state, right? If we just input zero to the LSTM, then like the hidden state here and here and here generally probably is not a great thing. So what we could do is we could use some number of steps out of these 80 transitions to be used just to boot up the hidden state, and that's the burn-in period. So the burn-in is some prefix which we don't use for anything else than just computing the hidden state, right? So we train the DeepQN only on the rest of the transitions after the burn-in, and the authors, they consider the burn-in of 0, 20, and 40. What the authors do is they measure the discrepancy, like the difference between the Q value predictions, considering all these combinations. So for example, here, there is a discrepancy, between using the zero state at the blue bars and the stored states at the red bars, for the initial state. So of course, if we start with the zero state, then the difference is major without the burn-in. If we use the burn-in, you can see that this goes down. So the difference, the discrepancy decreases with the burn-in, but it's still quite large. For the compared to the stored state, where you can see that, well, it's actually zero if you don't do any burning, because then it's exactly these values. And then there is some discrepancy if we use the burning, but it's not very large. And here we can look at the final state. So in the final state, we have already processed all 80 transitions. So you can see that in some cases, even the initial state goes down. But still, using the stored states seems to be much better. So these are just the discrepancies. So now let's look at the difference in behavior. These are the mean episodic criterions, so the behaviors of the agents which were trained using these six strategies. So the first one is using zero state with burn in of zero. Then we have got zero state with burning of 20, and with burning of 40, the performance is actually kind of better. Compared to the stored state without burning. However, the best strategy seems to be to use both the stored state and large burning. So we store the state, and then we still let the network to process it for 40 steps before we will actually learn something. And you can see that generally these dark red curves seem to be the best performing ones in all the experiments. So that's what the authors use in these results, right? So way they store the states at the time of actually performing these transitions, and they use the burning of 40 steps. So here are the results for Atari. We have seen the Impala already, which got to nearly 1,000 of the mean average of the mean human standardized returns. We didn't talk much about APX because I knew we will be talking about R2D2. So you can see that R2D2 is dramatically better. Here there is a nice graph. There is a rainbow here, original DQN, the Impala, there are these APX is, and then these are the R2D2s after 12 hours of training, 24 hours, 48, 72, and 120. So it's like dramatically good. It seems that this recurrent part of the network is the important difference. This APX is just, or APEX, is just the DQN in the distributed way, but without the recurrent neural network. So being able to plan for longer than just for one time step seems to be an important and crucial difference. To see at the, to look at what the hyperparameters look like, so we have some number of vectors. After each 400 steps, we send the data to the replay buffer and get the new parameters from the learner. Sequences are 80 steps. It seems to indicate from this that they actually use the prefix for the burn in. So it seems it would be 120. I kind of thought that they take it from the 80 steps, but this indicates otherwise. There is this replay buffer size, the priority exponent for the priority sampling. They use much larger discount, like until now we have seen 0.99, but they use larger one. We will see an ablation experiment showing that. There is a target network, the value function that is scaling, you know what that is now. Here is how the training progresses. So you can see at the beginning, the R2D2 actually does little, right? Like this is this 200 million frames for rainbow. So even after 1 billion frames, the R2D2 is still considerably worse. However, like at some point it starts actually training. I would think that at some point this LSTM stabilizes reasonably well, so it can actually learn something without the LSTM being changing too much. If we just get rid of the LSTM, so we just use everything but use only the feedforward, you can see that's the green line, that the result would be considerably worse. Well, still better than anything else, but the major important difference here is like I can enable it to plan, if I say it in this way. Now, nice ablations here. We can look at what the value rescaling does, right? So this clipped experiment, these blue ones, tell us how the result would look like if we use this original clipped rewards. And you can see that the results would be considerably worse in all the environments, or sometimes the same, but they are the ones which where it's really, really bad. Using the larger discount factor doesn't seem to be that important, right? Because here there is some difference. But on Gravitar, using the smaller discount actually seems to work slightly better than the same as Qbert, and it doesn't really matter here in Sequest. So using the different discount factor doesn't seem to be that important, but for some games, being able to look further with the 0.997 discount seems to be important. Yeah, and the feed forward, we know that it's an important thing. Also, until now, this loss of life heuristics was being used. Whenever the environment had lives and you lost, then the episode ended, and you start from the beginning with from the beginning of the episode. They evaluate this strategy. That's the life loss reset, right? This violet one compared to their original one. So sometimes it works better. Well, in many actually cases, these heuristics seem to produce better results, right, than their one. And their one is just to ignore the loss of the life. However, instead of just considering the reset strategy, they also consider the roll strategy. And the roll strategy means that the episode continues, but the estimates of the returns stop at the border, right? So you don't observe any positive points which you get after actually losing your life. So if it's a bad idea to lose a life, then these heuristics will make the agent not to do it. However, there are environments like Sequest when it's actually not good to lose lives in some circumstances. So if the lives are just ignored and the final return is the important thing, then the heuristics is hurtful. But for other ones, especially if there are like several possible number of lives, then trying to save them as possible is a good thing, and for that the heuristics actually help. This is the utilization of the memory, like how the agent actually uses the steps from the past. There are always two lines. One is the red one, which is the zero state, so initialized by zero, and the other is blue one, which means it's initialized by the stored state. And here we can see what the mean episode reward is. So at this infinity means we are actually using the history from the full episode. So in the stored state, we actually benefit from even seeing larger history than just in this segment of 120 steps. So I'm sorry, we always train for 80 transitions, and if we use the burn-in, it's added as another prefix of 40. So if we use the zero state, then actually we only use the last 40 or so steps and nothing more. Right, so whether we use 40 or 80 or even more doesn't really matter, because it kind of makes sense. Like the agent cannot actually get information from too far in the past, because like there's like a fixed limit where I just get a zero state. On the other hand, this stored state strategy allows the agent to utilize the memory, which is even further than this 120 steps, which was used during training. And that's something what we can see also, not in Atari also, but in the other environments. Here it actually seems that using the memory from a longer period of time is a bit hurtful, so that the LSTM probably cannot maintain a reasonable state after performing a lot of ablates. But anyway, it seems that the experience is important, especially in the zero state, so that it can actually use the long-term information, even if it was trained only on these fixed length segments. Yep. So this R2D2 is nowadays the one of the best performing DQN on Atari. The bad thing about it is, here are the results of various baselines. We know everything except for the mu0, so just ignore it. Here is an R2D2. What is a good thing is that when you look at this human column, then the only bold results are here. 5 games where the humans still seem to be better. So these are somehow hard exploration games, and neither R2D2 nor mu0 were able to beat them, right? So what is missing is to improve the situation. The authors in the R2D2 paper say that they believe that to actually improve in these difficult games, some algorithmic change will be necessary, because they have done, they don't say it explicitly, but what they mean is that they have done all the hard crunching. Like, you cannot just throw more resources on the same algorithm anymore. You will have to do something different. So that's something which we will do on the next lecture. On the next lecture, we will talk about a strategy which is able to achieve superhuman performance in all games, including this ones. So apart from that, R2D2 is pretty good. So now, are there any questions or remarks or something? So let's get to the last algorithm which we have for today. It seems that this recurrent nature edit or recurrent architecture edit to the agent in R2D2 is the crucial part. So in a sense, it seems being able to do to perform some kind of a plan seems to be important. But maybe instead of using some recurrent neural networks, we could use planning similarly to AlphaZero. And that's what the people from DeepMind did in a mu0 paper. The mu0 paper describes an algorithm which extends AlphaZero to a situation where we don't have the access to the model. So instead of having model, we will train it. That's what the mu here is. We will have a model, and the model is mu, so it's like a model zero. So what will we have? We'll have a model. And what the model will do is assume that currently the time step is t. And the model will be able to, for some number of steps into the future, it will be able to model predict the policy of performing some action, like given some number of observations. So we are in time step t, right? So we definitely have observations up until this time. We will be able to predict future action, but we will also be able to predict another future action by conditioning on the action which we already generated, right? So we have observed t steps in the environment, and now we'll have this model which will be able to plan into the future, right? So in the next k steps, when planning one of these steps, it will use this t observations and the number of actions which we performed up until that point. And so what the model will do, it will be able to predict the policy of the next action conditioned on the observations and the actions performed until that time. Now, these observations, they are from the partial observable MVP thing, right? We talked about it somewhere at the beginning, that sometimes we may not give access to the full states, but just the observations, and we somehow want to model the states by ourselves, which means we will model it, we will drop the Markovian property, in a sense, right? And we will model the state by conditioning on all the previous observations. That's why they are all there. So they are O's, and it's not just ST, but also from one. So the model will predict policy and the value function. This is something what also the alpha zero did, right? It was able to say what the policy and the value function should be, but it had it easier because it knew the states explicitly, right? So we didn't have to talk about it like this. We just used the model, applied the actions, and got the states immediately. Now we cannot do it, so we explicitly need to track the previous observation and then new actions. So the policy, the value function, and also the immediate reward. Right, where these U's are the observed reward. So the value function should actually predict the return, and the immediate reward should predict the observed reward. To be more specific, at each time step T, which we will just omit. The model consists of three components, the representation function, the dynamics function, and the prediction function. Don't worry, we will see all of them here and on the image. So the dynamics function, that's the MVP simulation. So that's something which will get a state and an action, and it will produce the next state and reward. Normally, the model would do this for us, but we don't have it, so this is where we train the model. And it doesn't have any explicit semantics or something. We don't really try to make sure that the states mean something. We just train it in this way and try to generate as best rewards, values, and policies as possible. So we call these S states, but they are not. They are just some internal representations, and they don't they are not really connected to the states in the MVP or something. It's just some representation. The prediction function is what we had in alpha zero. So given a state, we predict the policy and the value estimation. And we also need a new thing, which will be the representation function. And the representation function will take the observations until this point, and it produces this internal state, whatever it is, which is then used as the input to the prediction and the dynamics function, right? So whenever we want to perform some planning, then let's look at the image A. So we are in some, we have observed something until now. So we have seen observations O1 to OT. Now, if we want to run the Monte Carlo tree search, then we start by using the representation function, this is the H thing, right? And the representation function, so they use the blue color, so that's the representation function. And that will give us the suitable internal state, which we can use for planning, but generally it should embed all the information in the game until this point. Now in each node, we can compute the evaluation using the prediction function. And the prediction function gives us a policy and the value function. And now if we want to go down a node, we need to perform the action, which we do by using the dynamics function, right? So when we do it, we observe the reward and we get to the next state. And the next state, we once again can compute or use the prediction function. And if you want to go further, we can use once again the dynamics function and so on and so on. So using these three functions, we can still expand the tree, like the planning tree of the game or of the environment in the same way as we did in AlphaZero. So that's the main, I would say, main thing. Once we can run the Monte Carlo simulation, we will get the policy proportional to the visit counts, as in the AlphaZero case. So once we have finished the Monte Carlo tree search, we get the distribution over possible actions. We might sample one, and then we might continue, right? So the self-play games are generated as before by running some number of simulations, choosing the action according to the distribution, and repeating this over and over and over and over and over. The interesting part is the training part. So how do we train? Let's get to the image in a few minutes. The slide summarizes some of the or comments the images which we have just seen. So to select a move, we just run the Monte Carlo tree search, which generates a policy and a value estimate, and we sample the action from the returned policy. During training, that's the important thing. What we do is we utilize a sequence of K moves. So when we were training AlphaZero, we just applied the prediction function on the state directly, right? So let me draw it like here. We applied it directly to the state. We got the P and V. And then we immediately computed a loss, and the loss was just the mean square error between the value and the predicted value and the game outcome, plus there was the cross entropy loss between the policy returned by the Monte Carlo tree search and the computed one, and then there was the L2 norm. So this was AlphaZero, but now we need to train also the dynamics function. So what we do during training is that we take a sequence of five moves, right? So we have five of these. And instead of using them, we actually pretend that we are doing planning in this tree for the depth of five. So we apply the representation function to get the S0. Then we run the dynamics function for four steps, right? Then for these five hidden states, we run the prediction function. And now we will be adding the losses. So as for the losses, first we need to train these policies. So the policies are simple. The policies are being trained as before using the cross entropy loss between the policy returned by the Monte Carlo tree search in this real estate compared to whatever the neural network returns, right? So that's simple. However, we also need to train the value function. In Monte Carlo, in AlphaZero, we just finished simulating the game until the end. So we got the outcome of the whole game. But for Atari, we cannot do it, right? We can't train immediately. So we will use bootstrapping. So to get the estimate of return in time step t, we will use usual n step bootstrapping. So we will use 10 returns discounted. And then we will look at the prediction in after the n steps. This prediction is the value estimate produced by the Monte Carlo tree search in this t plus n time. Right, so 10 is very far ahead, but for this point, when we look 10 states into the future, we looked 10 steps further in the trajectory, the Monte Carlo tree search generated this value estimate. So we use that as the final estimate of the return in the episode. So this n is the 10 is being used in the paper while they unroll for 5. Right, so these are different constants. I was a bit puzzled when I was reading it for the first and second and third time. But this k tells us how long do we train the model, right? We unwrap the model 5 times and we want all these 5 generated states to work reasonably well. So it means during planning, we will be able to plan to the depth of 5. This n10 tells us how do we compute our return estimates. So it it's not connected with the planning in any way. It's just a way how to get some reasonable idea of how good some specific state is. So even if this is longer, it's fine. It could be probably even longer, but there is some trade-off which we've seen in the graphs already. So I assume this ended up to be the reasonable thing. So the loss then has 4 components. There is the like value prediction loss that was in alpha zero, the policy prediction loss that was in alpha zero, this was also in alpha zero, and there is a new component here, which is the reward prediction loss, because we also need to predict rewards, right? These rewards, normally they would be given to us by the model, and in alpha zero we actually didn't use them because all the games didn't have intermediate rewards, they only have the reward in the terminal state. But we need the dynamics model to train this as well, so we train this to match the observed rewards when we were generating the episode, right? That's somewhere here we talked that we call that U, but still U here. Yep. So as in a theory, the rewards are scaled, and yeah, I did the copy paste. You can see. So the x is still missing here. Sorry. If your head is not exploding yet, it will soon, because for some reason the authors they don't just compute the mean square error. So they just don't say okay, the transformed v minus transform z squared. But this probably had two large gradients if something was wrong. So what they do, it's a nice trick, is that they use a cross entropy loss. So when they predict the v, when the network predicts the value estimate, it doesn't do so by generating just one output. Right, this is how it looked until this, right? There was some hidden layer, one output, and just sums everything combined by the weight. What they do instead is they create an output layer of size 601. Apply softmax on it. And they use this layer to approximate or to represent a number. What I mean is that these outputs, they correspond to numbers minus 300, minus 299, and so on, 0, 1, and so on, 299, 300. So if you want to predict 300, you just shoot one hot encode 300, right? So if you want to know what value the network predicted, well, it's the weighted sum of these numbers, right? So we have a distribution here, and we like take the output distribution d, multiply it, like compute the scalar product with the vector minus 300, minus 299, and so on until 300, right? So we can use these as weights and multiply it by this corresponding value. But the good thing is that instead of just having one output, and it seemed to me that this is really doesn't have enough capacity, we can have like a different set of weights for different range or different strength of the predicted return. And during training, when we want to predict 3.25, right? What we do is we combine this from 3 and 4, right? We know that if we take, if we say, okay, so let's take 3 plus 4, so 3 times, I don't know, 3/4, right? Plus 1/4 times 4, this should be hopefully 3 and 1/4. Yes or no? Yeah, it is. Then we use this 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 3/4, 1/4, 0, 0, 0 as a target. So all the targets are like two hot representations which use the neighboring bins or the neighboring atoms to represent the value. So in a sense, this is just a technical thing. So if you are too disgusted by it, then just ignore it. So this is taken from the appendix, all the information. So the model is consisting of these three parts, the representation, the dynamics, and the prediction part. During search, we run Monte Carlo tree search on this generated state. We get the policy prediction and the value prediction. We play the action sampled according to the policy. And now during training, what we do is we run the network using the repeated application of the dynamics function and then the prediction function. We estimate the return for the games by using at the last reward for the general MVPs and Atari environment. We use n-step bootstrapping, and then like here is the value estimate of the Monte Carlo tree search in the 10 n steps in the future. The loss has these four components, and these four components for games, we don't predict rewards. The value is just estimated using mean square error and the policy using cross entropy. For the general MVPs, we use cross entropy for everything. So we use cross entropy for rewards, returns, and the policy. So images, graphs, something more interesting. So here they show what the result of mu zero is compared to alpha zero. So they train Chessyogi and Go without giving them the access to the rules, right? No model for them, not just try to play by themselves, but without explaining the rules as well. You can see that for the chess and shogi, the blue line, that's the mu zero, reaches the orange one, which is the alpha zero, without much problems. For Go, it actually surpasses it. What they say is that they think that the dynamics function in the Monte Carlo tree search performs some additional calculations as well. So like this trained model was able to learn more, to embed additional information to the trained state, which helps with the final performance. And here we can see the performance on the Atari games. This is R2-D2 with the no-op starts. This is R2-D2 in the human starts, and the blue one is mu-zero. So the mu-zero actually non-trivially surpasses the R2-D2. What's terrible is this training time. Like they say 12 hours. What they don't say is how much computation it actually required. Well, but if measured on the wall time, they are very good. And this is when you have like infinite amount of resources. They also evaluate themselves in the settings where they use just 200 million steps, which is what Rainbow did. And what they do is in these cases, they like reanalyze the experience. So they don't just, normally we have just run Monte Carlo tree search once on the experience in the transitions. And once it's got out of the transition buffer, we just got a new experience. But if you want to be much more careful, and they just use 1/100th of data, right, compared to this thing. What they do is they never throw away experience, but they sometimes rerun the Monte Carlo tree search on the already generated trajectories to get better estimates. Like when the policy changes, then getting new, like running new Monte Carlo research will get you better targets. And in these settings, they were able once again to get really the best results so far. So we don't have much time. We don't have any time. So I will go through these very quickly. I also had the details from the paper ready, but at this point, I think you know enough so that you could learn, you could read the original paper. So if you are interested in more details, then reading the appendix of the paper definitely is a good thing. There are like two or three more tricks which needs to be done. Probably to make everything work, but you have the overall idea. So just the some interesting calculations. This is the result of using the trained the trained model compared the real simulator. And here is the search time, right? So if you are searching for some number of time, then using the learned model is actually better than using the real one. But of course, at some point, the real one wins. The reason is that during training, we only train the trained model for 5 steps, right? So if we are training for longer, and then the model might diverge, like, or the model might be less precise. If you use the dynamics function 20 times, over and it was trained only for 5 steps, then it can just like get lost. Here you can see that like these are corresponding images, what the average search depth in the tree is. So during training we all use just 5, and during prediction you can see that this point happens at 20 seconds. So it happens when we were planning for something like 12 move aheads. So the model generalizes actually pretty well to even larger number of steps, not just 5 dynamic calls. That's for Go. For Atari, you can see that increasing the number of simulations doesn't help much, right? For AlphaGo, it scales like linearly with Elo actually. With Atari, increasing the number of simulations during prediction is not that great. Well, it improves a bit, but not that much. When we look at the number of simulations per move, we trained for 50 during, we like used 50 simulations during training, and we trained the model for the depth 5. But at some point, like here, it stops being better. So it seems that in Atari, the model stops being accurate after, I don't know, something like 10 steps. So at that point, it's hurtful to use it further because probably the predictions by the model are no longer corresponding with the settings. Like the models for the Atari environments are much more complex than for Go, right? You can just learn the rules. You just know where you can put the stone and that's it. With chess, you just learn which figure moves where. That's simple to learn. But for Go, when you try to like assume what will like plan what will happen in the future, then we train for 5 steps and we can plan for 10, but then it gets worse. Interesting thing is that in Atari, the number of simulations during prediction doesn't really matter. In Atari, the thing which we talked about at the beginning of the lecture happened. So the model is actually able to capture the behavior directly in the policy. So doing Monte Carlo tree search doesn't help much. That's the red line without Monte Carlo tree search, while the blue ones are with Monte Carlo tree search with some different number of simulations. So there is small difference, but not such a large one. But using the simulations during training is much more important. During training, if we just use the prior network, then we Okay, I am saying something different. So this is a different. This is the one which I wanted to show you. This is the graph which shows the performance on Atari. If you train for some number of simulations, if you train only with 5 simulations, then the model doesn't really train nearly at all. Right? With 6, it's much better. 7, 10, 25, and 50. So using the simulations during training is very important because it improves the estimates, but the model is actually capable of incorporating all the knowledge to the neural network compared to the AlphaGo or the Go, where it's the other way around. And like playing just using the prior network give some performance, but using some number of simulations, and this is just 800 simulations, still improves the results dramatically. So thank you very much for your attention. It was a bit mind-blowing, I would say, today. So generally we are at the point where I'm not going to like nitpick everything on the exam of what I said to you. It's like, imagine it more like seeing what's possible, but don't worry that I will want you to like read the papers and study the abstracts, the appendixes, so that you can go to the exam. Like at this point, it's more like a preview of what is actually available. So on the next lecture, we will deal with these 5 hard games and we'll be able to solve them. So thank you very much for your attention. We will see each other on the Wednesday's practicals. So looking forward to meeting you there. If you have some further questions, then by all means, please do ask them. But feel free, of course, to go outside. Well, it's dark outside, so to go have a dinner or I don't know, just punch something. Okay, so bye-bye if you are going, and I'm here if you want to ask something. Bye.